Welcome to this week's edition of the Wallingford and District Talking newspaper, bringing you news from the Wallingford Herald on Wednesday, the 18th of March, 2026. The readers this week are Alec, Pat and Bill. I'm your producer, Keith, and the copier and distributor is Helen.
Listed building may become HMO. Plans have been submitted to turn a Grade 2 listed building in the centre of Wallingford into a 7-bed HMO, which is a house in multiple occupation. An application submitted to South Oxfordshire District Council has proposed changing the building at 56 St Mary's Street in Wallingford, which is a mixed-use building, into an HMO. Permission for the change of use of the first floor, which is an office, although it has been vacant for a number of years, and the second floor, which is a flat, as well as alterations to reconfigure the space into 7 bedrooms, is required for the works to go ahead. The ground floor, which is split into 2 retail spaces housing Step Ahead Hair Salon and the old Wallingford Sweet Shop, would remain unchanged. The Georgian property is Grade 2 listed and has had multiple extensions in the 19th and 20th centuries. A heritage assessment submitted with the plan said the building has largely retained its historic layout and would have historically been in residential use.
Hello, this is Alec. Drivers angry at illegally high speed humps. Traffic calming bumps now uncomfortable to drive on following the road's resurfacing. Claims have been made that speed humps on a road in Wallingford are illegal after the street was resurfaced. The council says it's investigating after road users have reported the humps on Wantage Road in Wallingford were higher than the legal standard and had become uncomfortable to drive on, even below the speed limit. Man of 21 pleads guilty to threats to kill his mother. A young man has pleaded guilty to making threats to kill his mother. Callum Hunter of Goldsmiths Lane, Wallingford, appeared at Oxford Crown Court on Friday, March the 13th. The 21-year-old is charged with multiple offences committed in Wallingford on February the 4th this year. Hunter pleaded guilty to threats to kill, breaching a restraining order, intentional strangulation, and driving a vehicle without insurance or a licence. The court heard that the victim in the case was the defendant's mother, Tracy Hunter. Nick Cotter, mitigating, told the court that Hunter had been keen to be sentenced on Friday the 13th. However, a pre-sentence report was ordered. The court also heard that Hunter had struggled with addiction to cocaine and cannabis. He will be sentenced on the 17th of April.
Good evening, this is Pat. Waste permit deadline approaching. Householders across southern Oxfordshire have been warned not to leave it too late, as waste permits are set to change by the end of the month. Homeowners in South Oxfordshire and the Vale of Whitehorse have been advised to buy a new garden waste permit for 2026-2027 before the end of March to avoid bins going uncollected. A new annual permit for 1 year costs £78 per brown bin for residents in the districts to run until March the 31st, 2027, or a 6-month permit available from September costs £39. Permits renew every year and must be stuck to the lid of the brown bin it is registered to, as the district council will only empty garden waste from bins displaying a valid permit. People are advised to allow up to 10 working days for the permit to arrive. The colour of the permits relate to the year it was paid for and change each time a new one is issued. This year, the permits will be pink. Last year's permit should be left on the brown garden waste bin until after the last collection in March, with the new one replacing it ready for the first collection in April. More information and how to purchase the new permit is available online on the joint South Oxfordshire and Vale of Whitehorse Buy a Garden Waste Permit page.
Hello, my name is Bill. This article is entitled Railway Fans Buy Souvenir Platform Tickets, and there's a photo showing two rail enthusiasts holding up their souvenir tickets. Visitors to Didcot Railway Centre have been buying souvenir platform tickets. The museum at the railway centre has a machine which delivers a ticket when a penny is put in the slot and the brass handle is pulled. Kieran and Lottie were among visitors who visited the Steam Rail Heritage Centre's museum on Saturday and picked up the souvenirs. Thousands of steam rail enthusiasts visit the centre every year, where there are steam train rides, an engine shed and other attractions, including the museum, a shop and cafe. Frank Doubleton, a volunteer at the centre, said, "The steward has a stock of old pennies which fit the machine and can be exchanged for a current 20p coin. Platform tickets were introduced from 1914 so that people could make their farewell to travellers or welcome them on arrival. The tickets did not allow travel and were valid for an hour. The numbers 1 to 12 printed on the ticket allow the ticket collector to clip the hour the holder went onto the platform to show the approximate time they had spent there when they returned to the ticket barrier. If they came back several hours later, it would arouse suspicion that they had used the ticket to travel somewhere."
600,000 pound revamp for pool welcomed by a councillor. A significant investment in Didcot Wave Leisure Centre is vital to the town, according to a former mayor. This month, Didcot Wave and Tame Leisure Centres will benefit from a £600,000 investment to revamp the changing facilities, giving them a much-needed makeover. The changing room areas at both centres are in need of improvement to make them as modern and easy to maintain as possible. The refurbishments would include the installation of water-saving devices in the toilets and showers, and a new energy-efficient lighting system will be fitted. The changing area refurbishments will have an impact on some gym and studio customers due to the changing facilities being unavailable for a period of about 10 to 12 weeks while these works are taking place, and the expectation is that the work will be completed by the summer. South Oxfordshire District Councillor Mocky Khan, a former member of Mayor of Didcot, said, "I used to take my girls to Didcot Wave when they were growing up. It's one of the jewels in the crown for Didcot, and we need to invest in our assets and keep them up to date. It's absolutely vital that we do it. There are a lot of private gyms that have been open, and we need to ensure that our equipment at the leisure centre is up to date. I'm always fighting for the proper leisure provision and leisure facilities that we can be proud of, like the Cornerstone Art Centre and the Edmonds Park Pavilion. I want Didcot Wave to remain an asset. It needed an upgrade, and people need good gyms to exercise in as we try to combat the obesity challenge. I would welcome even more investment in due course. Users of the gym and studios at Didcot are advised to arrive gym ready while the works are being carried out. At Didcot Wave, there will be an access to the changing areas if needed, and at Tame Leisure Centre, there will be access at certain times of the day to the changing areas. The swimming pool services and classes will not be affected during this time. Both Tame and Didcot Wave will keep customers updated on the progress of work via their Facebook accounts and with notice boards at the centres. SODC is using a developer contribution from the local areas to fund the projects, which will cost a total of about £600,000. Tame £350,000, and Didcot 250,000. This work follows the investment of 140,000 at Didcot Wave last year to create two new studios for spin classes and another multi-use room. Peter Paul Barber, the Cabinet Member for Finance at SODC, said, "Both TAME and Didcot are very popular centres, and it's important that we do all we can to make sure that the facilities are kept to a high standard for users and meet the Sport England requirements."
Hotel worker stole £7,500. A woman stole more than £7,500 in cash from the Wallingford Hotel where she worked. Aiming Hickenbocken of Bellswains Lane, Hemel Hempstead, was recently sentenced at High Wycombe Magistrates Court. The 42-year-old pleaded guilty to one count of theft by employee between June and July 2024 in Wallingford by taking £7,826.06 in cash from the George Hotel. She must comply with the orders of the responsible officer to attend appointments for a maximum of 25 days. She must also complete 80 hours of unpaid work in 12 months, pay a fine of £107 and compensation of £7,826.06.
This article is entitled "Technical Issue Leads to Car Park Ticket Confusion." And there's a very small photograph of the Cattle Market car park. A car park in Wallingford has seen a technical issue with tickets printed by machines amid a ticket system change which has led to confusion for some drivers. South Oxford District Council has been trialling a ticketless parking system at the Cattle Market car park and Goldsmiths Lane car park in Wallingford since April last year. The trial recently came to an end, however, meaning car park users are once again required to use the machines to print and display tickets in their windshields. However, a glitch at the Cattle Market car park left drivers confused about the rules, as tickets printed at the machine still said receipt only and no need to display on the vehicle. Some were concerned that cars which were parked without a ticket on display after the ticketless trial ended would receive a fine from the council. However, the authority has now confirmed that no penalty charge notices were issued for non-display of a ticket in the Cattle Market car park whilst this issue was ongoing. A spokesman for South Oxford District Council said, "Our ticketless trial is now complete, and paper tickets once again need to be displayed in our pay and display car parks. Our car park contractor Sabre was made aware of a technical issue at the Cattle Market car park in Wallingford that resulted in the machines issuing the wrong tickets, but this has now been rectified. We will be launching our consultation over the permanent introduction of ticketless parking on March the 20th. Further details will be released nearer the time."
Back to the claims about speed humps. They're illegal after the resurfacing. Claims have been made that the speed humps on a road in Wallingford are illegal after the street was refurbished and the council say it's investigating. Multiple road users have reported the speed humps on Wantage Road are higher than the legal standard, and it's uncomfortable to drive on even below the speed limit. The maximum permitted height for a speed bump under the Highways Brackets Road Humps Regulations 1999 is 10 centimetres. And driving instructor Graham Rolfe said the Wantage Road humps are slightly higher than this. Mr. Rolfe of Cromarsh Gifford said the road is uncomfortable to drive on, and even with bigger, wider vehicles, you still feel the humps. Even though it's not necessarily safe, lots of drivers have taken to driving down the middle of the road to avoid them. Several reports have been made on the County Council's Fix My Street, where issues can be reported to the Highways Authority. One of them, submitted anonymously, said the speed humps are there as a traffic calming measure, but cars are able to drive down the middle of the road and avoid them. This is a very common occurrence, happening both during the day and night. This never used to happen prior to the road being resurfaced, as the speed bumps were closer together, meaning cars had no choice but to reduce their speed and drive over them. Other locals said they have stopped using Wantage Road entirely because of the speed humps, which makes it unpleasant to drive on, including the Mayor of Wallingford, Ros Lester. Ms Lester said, "We avoid driving along the road and try to use the bypass instead." The road was resurfaced in October last year, and despite reports of the speed humps have not yet been lowered. A spokesman for Oxfordshire County Council said, "We're grateful for residents making us aware of issues. Some remedial work has taken place since the project was completed, but inspectors will visit the site and see if any further work needs to be carried out." A response to the reports on Fix My Street said the priority for removal will be determined by the level of risk and associated concerns, assessed on a case-by-case basis. Immediate action will only be taken where an item poses a direct and imminent danger to motorists, cyclists, or pedestrians. Mr. Rolfe's interpretation of the response was that they're ignoring the fact that the contractor has installed them illegally and aren't going to do anything about it. He added, "I don't know why the council are reticent to fixing the issue. Perhaps they're focusing on repairing all the potholes first because they are getting more grief about them, but that's another story. The local road network is an embarrassment, and Oxfordshire County Council should be held accountable."
This article is accompanied by a very cheerful photograph of some of the members of Wallingford citizens, who were collecting rubbish on Saturday. 10,000 litres rubbish collected at Town Litter Pick. The organiser of the annual Wallingford Litter Pick has said that the turnout was inspiring, as more than 10,000 litres of rubbish was collected. Around 130 volunteers turned out in Wallingford on Saturday, March the 14th, to participate in the massive town litter pick organised by charity Wallingford 1155. Mark Brett, MBE, chair of the charity, who has organised the event for more than 15 years, said that while it was disappointing that there was so much litter on the streets that had to be collected, the scale of the response from the community was inspiring. "Events like this show the power of community volunteering, bringing people together and creating new friendships and helping to keep our town a place we can all be proud of," Mr. Brett said. "We are very grateful to everyone who took part. The litter pick was supported by the Wallingford Women's Institute, Style Acre, Body Training Studio, and the Mayor of Wallingford, and the Comrades Club Wallingford fed the volunteers after their busy morning picking up rubbish. Further collaborations came from Cromarsh Parish Council, the Brightwellcome Sotwell Scouts, who joined forces to help clear their streets and green spaces. Wallingford 1155 organises events like the town's fireworks display, Santa's sleigh, as well as the annual litter pick."
This article is entitled "Hospitals' Baby Death Rate Below Average." Oxford University Hospitals has recorded below average rates for newborn deaths. The Trust also recorded below average overall perinatal mortality rates, which cover deaths shortly before or after birth, for 2024, according to the latest national report from MBRRACE-UK. The report also shows that the Trust's stillbirth rate was in line with the average for similar services and highlights a general decline in perinatal mortality over the past decade, particularly in stillbirths. Yvonne Chrisley, Chief Nursing Officer at the Oxford University Hospital, said, "It is important to remember that behind every statistic is a bereaved family, and we remain very mindful at Oxford University Hospitals of the profound impact that the loss of a baby has on parents and loved ones. Our thoughts are with every family affected." As one of the country's largest specialist referral centre, catering for some of the most complex pregnancies and newborns, our teams continue to focus on careful case review, learning, and ongoing service improvement. Recent investments in maternity staffing, modern bereavement facilities, and improvements to clinical pathways form an important part of this work. We remain committed to providing consistently safe, compassionate, and high-quality care for all mothers, birthing people, babies, and their families. This article is entitled National Award for Supportive Celebrant, and there's a picture of Fiona Mack, who has received the Jules Maxine Award at the first celebration of Celebrants National Conference. A wedding celebrant has been recognised for her compassion and support with the National Award. Fiona Mack, based in Abingdon, received the Jules Maxine Award at the first celebration of Celebrants National Conference. The award honours the late Jules Maxine, a founding member of the Celebrant Circle, who was known for her warmth, humour, and fierce loyalty to friends and colleagues. Following her passing, the organisation introduced the award to recognise professional excellence, kindness, and community support. Jacqueline Kale, co-director of the Celebrant Circle, said, "Fiona stood out this year, receiving multiple nominations, praising her compassion, discretion, and willingness to support others."
Firefighters hailed for outstanding service. Firefighters and support staff have been honoured for their outstanding service. An award ceremony held at Blenheim Palace on Wednesday the 11th of March celebrated the dedication of workers from Oxfordshire County Fire and Rescue Service with a combined total of 410 years service. Rob McDoodle, the Chief Fire Officer and Director of the Community Safety, said these awards reflect decades of service to Oxfordshire's communities and the strength of a team that continues to support one another and deliver with professionalism and care. "I'm incredibly proud of all my colleagues this evening and grateful for the contribution they make to our organisation and the people of Oxfordshire." 11 firefighters were presented with His Majesty the King's Long Service and Good Conduct Medals, marking 220 years of collective service. 5 more firefighters received the commemorative clasp and certificates for 150 years of combined service. 2 support staff members were also recognised for 20 years of service. And there's a picture of the Chief Fire Officer with 4 of the recipients.
Some streetlights could be turned off, and there's a photograph of the County Council's cabinet led by Liz Leffman, who will have the final say. Streetlights in towns and villages may soon be turned off at the request of town and parish councils. Town and parish councils will soon be able to request to turn the lights off between 11:30 p.m. and 5:30 p.m. in rural areas, and from midnight to 5:50 a.m. in urban areas. This can only be done after a consultation is held with residents following a decision by Oxfordshire County Council. The County Council is responsible for 60,000 streetlights across the county and has already introduced measures to save energy, such as the using LED bulbs. The original scheme was supposed to save the county council on an estimated £400,000 a year, but the council has since said that this saving was not realisable. Oxford and other large urban areas, as well as major road junctions and remote alleyways, would not be able to apply to switch off the lights. We asked the clerks and chairs of some of the town and parish councils closest to Oxford what their next move is going to be and whether it supports switching off street lights. Parish councils for Wootton, at Abingdon, Burcott, Clifton Hampden, Wheatley, Cumnor, South Hinksey, Botley, North Hinksey, along with their councillor chairs, were all contacted for comment. However, not one replied to our questions. Killington Town Council, formerly a parish until February, when councillors voted to up its status, said the scheme does not apply to it. Sarah Kearney, clerk to Killington Town Council, said, "Due to Killington being classified as a large urban area, we fall into the same category as Banbury and Bicester. As a result, this particular scheme does not apply to us and we do not have the option to apply for reduced street lighting. The choice is instead available to the surrounding rural parishes such as Yarnton and Begbroke, who are able to decide whether they wish to participate in this scheme." Oxfordshire County Council spokesman said lights will likely to be switched off this winter after the lower tier councils submit their requests. He said the part night lighting scheme application process hasn't opened yet. We plan to send out an information pack to towns and parishes soon. Reviewing and consulting on the schemes will take place over the spring and summer, prior to their submission for Cabinet member decisions in the autumn, with implementation taking place much later in the year, November or December. Under the plans, Thames Valley Police would also review each scheme using crime and road safety data. There had been initially resistance to the initial plan put forward by the Thames Valley Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Barber and campaigners over safety, particularly for women and girls.
This article is entitled Plans to Refresh Business Park, and there's an aerial photograph of the existing Monument Business Park in Childgrove alongside the Childgrove Airfield. Plans for the redevelopment of a business park on a former airfield have been revealed and have been described as a refreshed vision for the historic site by the owner. Monument Business Park in Childgrove has operated for more than 40 years after the former airfield site was redeveloped following the Second World War. The site, which employs more than 600 people across 80 different enterprises, is not being used to its full potential, according to owner Wolf Capital, and the demolition and reconstruction of several buildings has been proposed. Applicant IMA Architects, submitting a report on behalf of Wolf Capital, said the business park is already a very strong employer in the area, containing a number of industrial, storage and office uses for multiple occupiers and businesses of differing sizes. There are certain areas of the site which are not utilised to their full potential and could be redeveloped as part of these proposals. Plans have been submitted to South Oxford District Council to redevelop several plots on the site in phases, with an initial full application seeking permission to rebuild four warehouses on plots F, G, H and A, constituting the first phase of on the western edge of the site. Each of the units will have new parking and cycle spaces on their plots, totalling room for 58 cars, and the application added that the highways network can comfortably accommodate the development, according to its transport statement. Outline planning permission is sought for a further two phases of redevelopment, for the demolition of existing buildings and the construction of up to 8,500 square metres of commercial floor space. In total, the full and outline planning applications would see the development deliver up to 12,700 square metres of new commercial floor space in the business park. This is a significant addition to the most recent similar development on the site, which was granted plan permission in 2014 for the expansion of the business park by 5,250 square metres of additional space and a 2.25 hectare solar farm. Monument Business Park already extends to 8.3 hectares, and this application applies to a total area of 3.6 hectares. It is adjacent to Tower Industrial Estates, which is northeast of the business park, and was granted outline plan permission in April 2023 for a mixed business and commercial development totaling 2.67 hectares. As well as a range of enterprises, the business park also accommodates several residential units where workers live on site, as well as a cafe, day nursery and meeting rooms. Monument Business Park was bought by Wolf Capital Holdings Limited in November 2024, having been under the ownership of Jennings of Garsington Limited since the park's establishment in the 1970s.
Workers £7,000 short of living comfortably. Workers in the South East say they need £47,000 a year to feel financially comfortable. That's £7,000 more than the average salary in the South East, highlighting a growing gap between earnings and the cost of living. The findings come from a survey of 5,000 UK professionals as part of Reed's latest salary guide report. Grant Rigler, regional director of Reed, said the South East often mirrors London in terms of living costs, but salaries don't always reflect that same premium. These findings expose a significant disconnect between what professionals earn and the income required to maintain a comfortable lifestyle in one of the UK's most expensive regions. The majority of South East workers, 56%, said they were satisfied with their pay, but 22% expressed dissatisfaction. Of those unhappy with their earnings, 57% said pay had not kept up with the rising living costs. Nearly a third, 28%, said they have £100 or less left after their monthly bills, while 9% said their entire wage is spent on essentials, leaving no disposable income. Mr. Rigler said that job market behaviour is shifting. He said, "We are noticing a cooling in the job market's volatility. Professionals in the South East are adopting a wait-and-see approach. Unless a new offer comes with a significant financial uplift or guaranteed stability, people are choosing to stay put."
This article is accompanied by an artist's impression of the new bridge. Science Bridge project is set to get underway soon. A major transport project is moving closer to construction. The Didcot Science Bridge, part of the wider Didcot and surrounding areas major infrastructure scheme, aims to reduce congestion, improve journey times, and boost connectivity for pedestrians and cyclists in and around Didcot. Oxfordshire County Council has appointed Volker Fitzpatrick to build the bridge, which will also support new housing and employment opportunities. Judy Roberts, Oxfordshire County Council's Cabinet Member for Place, Environment and Climate Action, said, "I am very pleased that we have reached the stage where we have appointed Volker Fitzpatrick to build an important section of the scheme. This means work will start soon on this transformation and the infrastructure development. It will offer more sustainable travel options in and around Didcot and provide opportunities for more direct, faster and more reliable bus routes. It will also improve road safety and support the creation of new jobs and economic growth in the local area. This project includes improvements to existing roads, the construction of new roads, new walking and cycle routes, and will help to facilitate a new and enhanced bus service. The construction contract covers the creation of a dual carriageway along the A4130 east of the A34 Milton interchange and a new single carriageway bridge crossing the railway line and Milton Road. An upgraded A4130 will include two additional westbound lanes towards the Milton interchange, while the existing carriageway will serve eastbound traffic towards Didcot. The three-span Science Bridge will cross the A4130, the Great Western Main Line Railway and Milton Road, running through the site at the former Didcot A power station to reconnect with the A1430 north of Purchase Road roundabout. Paul Lilly, Strategic Projects Director at Volkerpitz Fatrick, said, "We are delighted to have been appointed to deliver this Didcot Science Bridge, a key component of this transformative infrastructure programme. Our team brings extensive experience in delivering complex civil engineering projects, and we look forward to working closely with Oxfordshire County Council and its partners to create infrastructure that will improve journey times, enhance sustainable travel options, and support future growth across the region. Main construction is expected to begin in the spring and will take about 2 years to complete."
This article is entitled "Thousands Go to Recycling Centres But Don't Pre-Book." A common mistake made by thousands of people over a new rule at the recycling centres of Oxfordshire has prompted a reminder by the County Council. Around 15,000 people have made the journey to the county's Seven Tips but not booked in advance of their arrival. Householders must now book a slot to use any of the Oxfordshire County Council's household waste recycling centres through a system on the authority's website. The majority of the 58,000 trips made to the tip since mid-January were pre-booked, but thousands still either forgot or don't know they have to book. Judy Roberts, Oxfordshire County Council's Cabinet Member for Place, Environment and Climate Action, said, "Between the booking system going live on January the 14th and March the 1st, there have been more than 58,000 visits to Oxfordshire household waste recycling centres. Around 74% of these visitors booked in advance, so we really need to ensure that the other 26% are aware that they need to book in advance. It only takes 2 minutes to make a booking online. Bookings are available up to 2 weeks in advance or 30 minutes prior, subject to availability. Residents without internet access can book slots over the telephone by contacting the Council's Customer Service Centre on 01865 519 800 between 8:45 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday and 8:45 to 4 p.m. on Fridays. Proof of address, such as a driving licence or a recent utility or council tax bill, is needed, as visitors from outside the county will be charged £15. A council spokesman added, "To date, there have been good availability and far less queuing on site. The most popular slots have been on weekends, particularly between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. As well as better traffic management, the booking system can increase recycling rates as staff are able to help visitors separate their recyclable from their non-recyclable waste. Analysis has shown up to 60% of material deposited in the non-recycling containers is, in fact, recyclable. Customers are asked to sort all their recycling, ideally before arriving at a household waste recycling centre. For those attending with unsorted waste, sorting stations are available to help separate out as much recycling as possible. This is better for the environment and helps the council to avoid larger disposal costs."
Rail ticket rule changes are baffling. Didcot, Wantage and Wallingford MP Ollie Glubber has dubbed the new rail ticket rules as baffling and complicated as he calls for the government to reconsider. Off-peak and any-time tickets purchased from the start of next month will be refundable up to 11:59pm the day before they become valid for travel, unless services are disruptive. Retailers will also consider claims from ticket holders unable to travel because of exceptional circumstances due to such things as a medical emergency. No reason needs to be given to obtain a refund if the tickets are unused by returning them to the place of purchase within 28 days of their expiry date. Mr. Glover and Liberal Democrat spokesman for transport has written to the Rail Minister, Lord Hendy, urging his department to consider. He said, removing the ability to obtain a refund from a walk-up ticket erodes one of the key advantages of the more expensive tickets compared to the cheaper and more restrictive advanced purchase fares. This runs the risk of penalising individuals who buy their ticket in advance in order to avoid last-minute panics on the day. Alongside this, the change is likely to have a significant impact on corporate bookings, which are rarely done on the day and may be more prone to on-the-day cancellation of meetings due to changing business requirements. This change could also disproportionately affect elderly and vulnerable individuals, exemplified in a 2024 Department of Transport report, Ticket Purchasing Behaviour and Preferences Among Rail Passengers. Crucially, respondents aged 66 plus were more likely to purchase their tickets from a station ticket office compared with the younger members of society, which implies less confidence with ticketing terms and conditions compared with those who buy without staff assistance, and a higher likelihood of avoiding purchasing at the last moment. In summary, this change adds to an already baffling and complicated set of rail tickets arrangements, which ultimately fails to meet the needs of passengers in the 21st century, while also potentially disproportionately affecting vulnerable and elderly train users. The industry body, the Rail Delivery Group, said the change is aimed at ending refund abuse, which refers to tickets that have been used but not scanned or stamped, and is estimated to cost about £40 million annually. And there's a nice picture of Ollie Glover on the platform with a train.
Free wheelie bin stickers has a little picture of somebody holding a heart with 20 miles an hour sign in the middle. Residents across the county can now apply for free wheelie bin stickers promoting safer streets. The stickers, a reminder that 20's plenty, are being offered by Oxfordshire County Council to mark the county's 275th 20 miles an hour scheme. Since launching the 20 miles per hour programmes in 2022, the council has worked with communities across Oxfordshire to introduce lower speed limits where requested. To support the milestone, the council has teamed up with the national campaign group 20's Plenty for Us to distribute the stickers free of charge. Residents can request up to 10 stickers per household by visiting the 20's Plenty website. Warning: after asbestos found in the wildlife park toys. And there's a nice picture of a stately home and three rhinoceroses grazing and some purple alliums in the front. The Cotswold Wildlife Park has warned that some of the toys sold in its gift shop may contain traces of asbestos. The attraction near Burford is issued an urgent project recall over the weekend on two of the toys previously on sale in its souvenir shop. They are the 2.2 kilogram squishy hot colour large gorilla and stretchy monster 6 assorted Try Me blister cards. Wildlife Park staff said, "We have been made aware of the following items sold in the park's gift shop are being recalled by the suppliers due to a safety issue. If you have purchased one of these items, please remove it from use immediately. We have been made aware that the following items sold at the park's gift shop are being recalled by the suppliers due to a safety issue. If you have purchased one of these items, please make sure it is removed and contact the gift shop via shop@cotswoldwildlifepark.co.uk or call 01993 825716. We will reimburse anyone who has brought one of these items with the affected batch numbers. We sincerely apologise for this matter and thank you for your understanding." It added, "As part of our ongoing commitment to product safety, our company policy to ensure our products meet all safety standards in line with UK and European legislation. Despite all the measures we have taken, we have identified a potential problem with the product shown above. Testing has identified that the sound-like material contained in some products may contain trace amounts of asbestos. Therefore, as a precautionary measure, we are recalling the product from sale. If you have purchased the product shown, stop using immediately and follow the below procedure. If the toy is undamaged, place it in a heavy-duty plastic bag and double tape it securely. If the toy is damaged and the sand inside is accessible, gather the sand using wet cloths to avoid generating dust. Wear gloves and a mask. Double bag the sand and toy in a heavy-duty plastic bag. Double tape it securely along with the gloves, mask and cloths. Keep children and other people away from areas where the sand has been exposed until the area has been cleaned."
This article is entitled "Much Loved Traditional Village Pub on the Market for £585,000 and is a picture of the Queen's Head in Cromarsh, Gifford. A much-loved village pub has been put up for a £585,000 sale. The Queen's Head in Cromarsh, Gifford, near Wallingford, has been listed by Everard Cole on the property website Rightmove. Along with the pub area, the property has three double bedrooms, a family bathroom and lounge. The traditional pub has a largely open-plan trade area, wooden flooring, open fires and exposed beams. In addition, it has a vaulted dining area and a traditional bar with a mixture of fixed and loose seating. To the rear is a commercial trade kitchen with extraction, as well as customer toilets, and behind the bar is a large lower ground floor cellar with access for deliveries to the front. Outside, it has a raised deck seating area and a rear grass trade garden with a sizeable rear tarmac car park with approximately 40 spaces. Overall, the site on the village's high street is half an acre and, according to its website, remains open every day aside from Mondays and Tuesdays. In 2024, the pub was handed a 2 out of 5 food hygiene rating by South Oxford District Council's Environment Health Team. Prior to that, in 2020, the pub's owners were ordered to pay almost £6,500 for breaching food and safety rules after rat droppings were found in the food storage areas and the kitchens were not adequately cleaned.
And here's an item from the Wallingford Herald website. Microsoft executive filmed at Henley Bistro hours before death. A Microsoft executive was filmed at a Henley Bistro hours before her death with a man currently awaiting trial for her murder. The Daily Mail has shared a CCTV video of Jennifer Simons calling into a Mediterranean-style bistro in Henley just past 9 p.m. on Thursday, March the 5th. Wearing a full-length black jacket, the 44-year-old is with a male friend and chats briefly to staff who tell her the kitchen was closed and she left. Her body was found off Phyllis Court Drive in Henley at about 7:50 a.m. the next morning, half a mile from the restaurant. Police tape was wrapped around the pavilion at Phyllis Court Club as police shut off the towpath opposite the club and asked rowers not to pass. Since then, it has been revealed that Ms. Simons was a senior customer success account manager at Microsoft working in Reading. Nelia Gouveia of Phyllis Court Drive, Henley, appeared in Oxford Crown Court for the first time on Wednesday, March the 11th. He is charged with one count of murder. A trial date with a time estimate of 7 days was set for September the 1st. A plea and trial preparation will take place on May the 29th.
This is another item from the Wallingford Herald website. Oxfordshire artist goes viral for showing her work in public. An Oxfordshire artist said her art is all about adventure and exploration as she grows viral online for showing her work in public places. Harriet Riddell, who grew up in Watlington, South Oxfordshire, works in the medium of thread and fabric, stitching her artwork onto pieces of cloth using a sewing machine using a free motion embroidery technique. The 35-year-old artist's setup involves parking a bike in a public space and using it to power her sewing machine, inviting passers-by to contribute to the art through pedal power. She took her unique textile performance art to Oxford University's Museum of Natural History, where she created a textile artwork of the building's stunning architecture, powered by the pedalling of visitors and informed by the artist's interaction with them. A video filmed at the museum of Miss Riddell stitching her artwork went viral as the latest in her travels around the world with her sewing machine set up, drawing what she hears and sees in Stitch. Miss Riddell, who calls herself Stitchu, a play on in situ, said, "My love of textiles started when I was about 5. My mother taught me how to use a sewing machine, and then my grandmother taught me the three motion embroidery techniques I use today when I was about 10. So textiles has always been part of my life, but it took 3 years at art university to sort of come back round full circle to where I started. Although at first she had only the sewing machine to take to cafes and pubs, laundrettes, bookshops and elsewhere, wherever she could find a table, a chair and a plug. Miss Riddell soon developed a more portable setup. She used motorcycle battery and inverter to power herself on adventures in India and Kenya, Taiwan and South Africa. Then discovered she could be powered by people on the street if she could convince them to ride a bike, which connected them to the art. Miss Riddell will be participating in Oxfordshire's Art Week from Watlington High Street this May, taking bookings and exhibiting her art.
And now some local events taking place in the near future. On Saturday the 21st of March at 7 p.m. at Dorchester Abbey, there will be a concert by OSJ Voices and Orchestra, with Rosalind Ventris Viola playing Walton and Rachmaninoff. The conductor is John Lubbock. Rosalind Ventris is Director of Music at the Yehudi Menuhin School. Tickets are £17.50 to £30. For more details, visit osj.org.uk. And again at Dorchester Abbey, on Saturday the 28th of March, between 6:45 and 9:45 p.m, there's Rock Choir Live. This is a charity concert for Wallingford Family Centre and the Sue Ryder Oxfordshire. Enjoy an evening of feel-good music with Rock Choir. Your ticket helps local families to access vital services and ensures compassionate palliative care locally. Tickets are £25 and you can visit tickettailor.com/events/Wygood Way Wallingford Family Centre, or one word, /1957795.
And finally, who is Banksy? The artist's real identity supposedly revealed. The identity of British artist Banksy may finally have been revealed after years of speculation. Banksy is famous for his graffiti artwork, which has appeared across the UK and around the world, including in Ukraine and the West Bank barrier. He's managed to avoid being named since first catching the public's attention in the late 1990s. However, a recent investigation by Reuters is believed to have finally uncovered Banksy's identity. He is believed to be 51-year-old Robert Gunningham from Bristol, according to Reuters. A signed confession from 26 years ago in New York State is said to be what gave him away. The Reuters investigation claims to have proof of Banksy's identity, but his lawyers deny the claims and say his identity remains a secret.
That brings us to the end of this week's recorded items. Following this, there will be the next instalment in our oral history. So don't switch off. But in the meantime, from this week's readers, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
So thank you very much for taking part. And could you give me your name and your age when day you were born?
Right. My name is Adrian Payne. I was born in Watlington. And I'm 86 years old.
Okay. And you came to live in Wallingford quite early in your life?
14 days old.
With it?
It's solely because Wallington Hospital had better facilities for an older mum.
Oh, so how old was your mum when you were born?
36.
Yes, it would be an older mum. And you were the second child, am I right?
Yes. Yeah, just the two of us, my sister, 4 years older than myself.
Right. And where in Wallingford did you live?
My first memory of a house in Wallingford was 38 High Street, which no longer exists, of course. It got wrapped up in the Waitrose development.
I see. And what's that? That's the new Waitrose.
Yes. It used to be a row of, we had the council yard behind, the town office, the borough offices in those days was down the road, all in the high street. Can't remember who was on the first corner. It ended up with a dairy, Lester's Dairy. And that's the Cholsey Lester's. And then there was a space and there was a little cottage where Mr. Wichelow lived. And we lived next door at 38.
Right. And did you have much of a garden?
No. We had a large shed in the yard.
So what was the shed used for?
Oh, I don't know. Pop used it for something.
Yeah. So what did your father do?
Father was an optician.
Oh.
But he was also a special constable during the war years.
So what did that involve, being a special constable?
well, it's equivalent to today's PCSO. So I used to do night duty, not go around filling door handles, which they don't today, and patrolling, point duty on the traffic lights, point duty on Lamb Crossroads, because the Lamb was a pub in those days, and the road was narrower.
So you lived there until what age?
I lived there until I must have been, I'm just trying to think. Sister and I disagree slightly on this date. I think I lived there till I was, I think it was 1947. Yeah, it must be, it was after the war, 1947.
So all through those war years, you were actually in the town centre.
A recce pilot billeted with us from RAF Benson. Flew Spitfires, did the dams raid, and his wife. And then one of the daughters came as well until the end of the war.
Did you say he went on the dam raids?
He was the photography before and after.
All right. Yeah.
He flew a Spitfire over there, unarmed Spitfire. I've only just tweaked that there are several people who were there at that time. They're no longer alive, any of them, but they settled in Wallingford.
After the war?
Yeah. A lot of them married local people. And I know one of our local doctors, Dr. McMullen, he married, or his daughter married, Charles Wilkinson, who was a doctor, and took over the practice in the end.
Right, and where was the doctor's surgery in those days?
Each doctor had their own surgery. McMullen was Blair Lodge, next to the old police station. That's the junk corner of, St. Lucian's Lane. I don't know their names. And one of them was in Petty's old wool shop, which is in St. Mary Street next to the Ridgeway coffee shop. There was a group in there. And I can't think of the ones up Castle Street, whether they... Because they served, they were in the services at the time, a lot of them. Oh, yeah.
And of course, it was in the days before the NHS, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had Dr. Warburton. I can't think where he ran his practice from. In our family's opinion, not a very pleasant man.
Well... So, where did you go to school?
I started off at the Kynecroft School. Then I went up to the grammar school. And age 11, I left there. And went down to the West Country to the old family school, Taunton.
I see. So you were a boarder then. You went to boarding school. So how old were you when you went to boarding school?
11.
Right. So what was the Kynecroft school like? How big was that at the time?
Jackie, she taught that. Not in those days. It was quite big. It must have been half a dozen teachers, even in those days. Outside Lewes.
This is the building that's called Centre 7
today. That's right.
Yeah. Outside Lewes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yes. It hasn't changed internally a great deal. So there must have been 4 or 5 there. Yeah, a friend of mine, Tony Maxwell, we used to go down together. He went off to school into elsewhere. And after that, he... moved with his family to Surrey. And I didn't catch up again till we met in the army in Cyprus.
Really? Yeah. Coincidence.
That was arranged.
Was it? Right.
In those days, you could do things.
So then you went to the grammar school, you said, and that's the...
Junior grammar school.
Junior grammar.
Yeah, we had our class in the Odd Fellows Hall, again a building which no longer exists. It's a sort of sensory garden in New Road now, what's left of it, because where you've got the green tree, the road used to come out a stage further, all the way down.
Uh-huh.
And you had a chap called Magnus on the corner. He was a tailor.
So the school was in the green tree car park, more or less?
No, right on the corner.
Right on the corner?
Right on the corner.
It wasn't a very big building, ma'am.
But when you had an... Had another length like this under it, yes.
Yeah, that's about the size.
Two classrooms.
Yeah.
They weren't that large, of course.
Well, how many children were in the classrooms? Can you remember that, Albert?
I think we had about 20, 25.
In each class?
Yeah.
All right. And what sort of subjects were you being taught? Can you remember that?
Oh, just a general... General in those days of 3 hours.
3 hours. No history or geography.
I can't recall any. I know I was there in 47 because we had that very cold winter. Very cold winter.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
You didn't have the heating or the clothing in those days.
No. Very cold.
And then, you know, after that, I lost touch with Wallingford until I came home on holidays from 11 till, oh, I don't know, how long was I down there? 6 years?
Mm.
Yeah, 5 or 6 years. And then I was, of course, an adult. Well, getting on that way, I was 17, pretty well, when I finished for school.
Yeah. Yeah, so can we go back to your childhood then? So,
yeah.
What do you remember about the games you played and those sort of things? What did you and your friends do when you weren't in school?
You know, it's a difficult one. The girls used to skip, play hopscotch and such like. I think we played hockey. That was the in-game in Wallingford, right the way through. Rugby didn't exist till 1948. And football did, of course. But the grammar school played hockey. A chap called Smogivari came there as a gym master in 1948. He sort of skipped out of the Polish Olympic team, apparently, so the story goes. And he brought rugby because he screwed some uprights to the football posts. And he used to have a gym club in the school hall. But all these buildings are gone, you know.
Yeah.
You've
seen some changes in Wallingford.
Oh, terrible.
Yes. But can you throw your mind back to the wartime in Wallingford? Do you remember that plane coming down?
Very much so.
Could you describe what happened?
Well, I remember. I can't think why or how. Perhaps parents or mother, because father was working at that time of day, took me outside and we looked up. Standing in the high street, we looked up and there were billows of smoke, I think. and a little tiny plane with a red cross on it was looking at it and then moving out. And then I remember the bang when it came down in Newnham Fields. And I remember if you go around certain buildings in town, there are certain places where you'll see just a broken corner of a glass. It was never replaced. I couldn't afford the glass or couldn't get it. And there's a lot of those about.
Really?
It's quite a few in the marketplace. I don't think the current owner, I haven't asked him. I shouldn't think he replaced them. You don't replace until necessary, really.
So it's worth going to look for these bits of missing glass.
Oh, yes.
How interesting.
So it needs to be the older buildings. Maybe something in wall cuts, as I guess.
So were many windows broken?
Oh, possibly quite a lot, yes. I don't think we lost any.
Yeah.
Of course, I was living in the High Street and the grandparents were in the marketplace then. I don't recall Pop telling me any gone, but it's possible. I'm sure some did. It's quite an impact.
Must have been, yeah.
Very brave men.
They were.
Very, very brave men.
Yes. Of course, there's a memorial for them, isn't
there? Yeah, Andrew and Wilding up
there. Yeah.
Hence the name of the two roads.
Yes, named after them. Yes, Andrew.
Then they still come, or members of the family still come to the service.
Yes. Yes, and that's held once a year, isn't it, the service?
Near a Sunday to the anniversary. And, of course, going back to the war years, I remember the Canadians and the Americans down on the concrete, which is in front of, my mind's gone blank, down by the river.
So they were they based near here?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where their camp was, but what we call the concrete's about 18 inches thick.
Down by the river?
Down by the river. Charlemore Gardens.
Oh, yes, I know. Yeah.
Those houses weren't there then.
Oh,
and the house at the end of the road there on the right was St. Leonard's Rectory. On the right, sorry. Dr. McMullen lived on the left-hand side and the rector on the right-hand side. And they used it to build Bailey Bridges and train on Bailey Bridges.
Did they? To cross there? They trained on the Thames just here?
On Thames here, prior to D-Day.
Was that the Americans or the Canadians?
Both.
Both of them.
And Brits, probably.
All together, sure.
I mean, it was a training area. And there was a field ambulance based here. I can't remember the number, but that was how Dr. Wilkins had came to Wallingford.
And so there must have been quite a number of military personnel.
When they were always going through town, they were very good, really, most of them. You got the old roughneck. You had to watch your bike being pinched. They used to pinch it, even a tiniest bike pinch it to get back to camp.
Can you remember where the camp was? Oh, no, I can't remember that.
No, I remember there were a lot of camps. I remember a big camp in the woods at Nettlebed.
Really?
Also one on the way into Reading on the right in the woods. Huge one there. Not camp, but storage. It was smelly. Paint. Cellulose paint. And, of course, you had the ordnance at Ditcote. And a huge stick of Ditcote. Now, I remember people like old Mr. Harris. Had a business across the way where and where the Dully Brasserie is, he owned all those shops, and a couple down the high street, and a big yard behind out as far as the Ballcroft. And he was always one for a bargain. I remember him. I remember the lamplighter coming along with his hook stick, turning the gas lamp on.
Oh, but boy. So there wasn't any electric street lights?
Oh, no.
No, they were all gone.
No, and where, just by the water tower, were the gas works. And more or less where Beeching Way is. There was gas works. I can't remember. Do you know, my mind's got Mr. and Mrs. Holt. He was a big fellow and she was little and short. She had parrots and he was in charge of the gas works. And they used to produce coke and gas, of course, which served the town.
Yeah. And was the station there then?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the station was there.
Yeah, the bunk station. Well, the Americans called it the Galloping Goose. Yes. And that ceased working in the 50s. Yes, please, just a topper.
More tea.
Yeah.
So the station was the Galloping Goose.
Yeah, and we used to travel on the train when we went to Reading. I mean, in those days, the best buses went through to Pangbourne, on to Reading that way. Now, of course, they go over the hills and far away. Where the Oxford Bus Company had their depot in Wallingford, behind what is now St. Albans Car Park.
No.
Part of that.
Yeah.
It went in about where the entrance is to Waitrose now.
Yes.
And it went down a slope into there and Harris's garage down there.
But not many people had cars in those days, did they? There weren't many cars.
Not many. Messenger was the taxi. Percy Messenger. Yes, used to do very well on the premium bonds or something similar. Wherever he went, he bought one. So he had them spaced out all over the country.
Were there premium bonds?
Well, similar.
Similar?
Something similar.
Why?
But all these things. Can't remember when they came in, but...
Well, they came in, we'd been married some time, because I cashed mine to pay for the carpet in the front room in the marketplace.
Yes, I remember them coming in, yeah.
Well, perhaps...
It must have been...
Perhaps he bought a post load or something.
Yeah, so it was something like that.
And stored them up.
So did you have, in your house, did you have electricity?
Yes. Marketplace downstairs. Upstairs it was gas, and I think Uncle Lewis put some electric in, and then we had the Wessex put some more in.
Yeah.
That was after the war, wasn't it?
Oh, it was after the war.
Yeah. So during the war, when you were a small child, you had electricity downstairs. Yeah. And your mother cooked with electric or with gas?
Yeah.
From the gas works, so it was just
a... Yeah. Town gas.
Town gas.
It smelt.
Didn't it? What did it smell of? Something?
Well, sulphur, really. You could always tell if you'd left a gas tap on.
Yeah.
And you often had to drain your pipe too, because it was quite wet. We had a tap in the cellar of the marketplace.